Hello, and welcome to Destination USA, a podcast from Index Ventures. Our series of firsthand accounts of how Europe's leading entrepreneurs and operators expanded their businesses to the US. Today's episode is all about cutting through. How do you capture the imagination and attention of American customers and get yourself known in the world's biggest economy? The guests we have joining us are Michelle Kennedy, the founder and CEO of Peanut.
Starting in the US was a no-brainer. We knew that we wanted to capture that market. We knew that we wanted to succeed there.
Christian Rieber, founder and CEO of Pitch.
I think press has also become far less effective than in 2010. And I'm curious what the others think here.
And Joe Cross, the former US general manager and global head of marketing at Wise, formerly TransferWise.
I think it's foolish to think of it as one country because it is more like a continent, and there are very few moments that you have in that country to reach the entire country.
Journalist Sohe Panja leads you through this conversation.
So to kick off, Michelle, I wanted to start with you. So you did something that perhaps flies against perceived wisdom. You launched Peanut simultaneously in the UK and the US. Not only were you an unknown entity in the US, you were unknown even in the UK at the time. Isn't it hard enough to get yourself known in one of these places at the beginning?
Yes, it is. I think we just had these global ambitions. You know, the problem that Peanut is solving is not just aimed at women in the UK or Europe, and it's not just aimed at women actually in the US either. This is a global issue faced by women, and last time, you know, we checked, it's 50% of the population that we're potentially impacting and benefiting. So starting in the US was a no-brainer. We knew that we wanted to capture that market. We knew that we wanted to succeed there. And actually, we kind of thought about it in the reverse. The UK was very much a kind of, we may as well because we're here and we're based here. But actually, our focus was always on the US.
Can you just tell us those first few weeks? Were you literally seeing Peanut get off the ground in both America and London from your laptop and seeing customers coming in on both sides? What was that? What was it actually like at the time?
Firstly, terrifying. Any founder will attest to that. It's absolutely terrifying. So when we first kind of went live, what had actually happened is there'd been a piece of press about us in the Evening Standard, and it had gone live the day before we were on the App Store. So people were downloading the beta, which was just one of those awful moments where you're like, no, please wait, come back tomorrow. But, you know, it certainly got momentum going. A few days later, I was on the way to New York, sitting in a hotel room with one of my colleagues, kind of sitting next to each other in bed at 3 a.m., working away and just starting to see the US come to life and US kind of downloads. So it was amazing to see it, but it was that simultaneously. It was within days.
Christian, you're in a similar place right now. You launched Pitch in October last year. How did you approach the market?
Yeah, so we always had a very global approach from the start. The internet is global by default. So since we are building a software product, we have always focused on the English-speaking market first. We have launched October the 20th. We now have customers in more than 100 countries worldwide, US being the largest market. We, to be honest, don't really do anything specific to be successful in the US, except maybe focusing on having a very diverse team so we understand those markets naturally. But there are no special marketing activities needed, I think, for software products other than build the very best product you possibly can.
I'd like to come to that in a moment, actually, but worth noting that you already had a successful exit with Wunderlist in 2011. And I wonder if the way you're approaching the US is different or is informed in any way by the experience of Wunderlist.
Yeah, so Wunderlist was an interesting experience for us because we basically built the very first version within just a few weeks, launched it, and then were most downloaded app on iPhone worldwide and basically had exposure in every country on the planet. And over time, we perfected the product, we formed a leadership team, increased the company in size, We've also tried to hire people in the United States, which worked out with mixed results, I must say. But yeah, I think especially during these like COVID times, it's actually not possible really to open an office anywhere right now. And it's not necessary for most digital businesses. I think if you're in different kinds of industries like fintech or so, it might be different than if you build a productivity app like us or like Wanderlist.
Joe, Christian touches on fintech type businesses like TransferWise, I suppose. And you guys waited, what was it, about 6 years after the launch in Europe to make the move to the US. And just the sound of Michelle and Christian's responses, they seem a lot more kind of relaxed and casual about expanding to the US than perhaps startups were 5-6 years ago. Tell me about the timing for TransferWise. And do you think, with hindsight, that timing was right? And do you think if TransferWise was perhaps a bit too European and had a bit too many European assumptions by the time you got to the US?
So TransferWise launched in 2011 to customers, I think, in Europe. And I think it was 2014 where we started really properly allowing people to send money to the US, which was half of the puzzle. And then the other half of the puzzle in each market is to then let people send money out of the country as well. And once we had both directions available, that's when we considered a market really live and able to grow it. That was the only blocker, really, was how fast we could get there and all the regulatory hurdles and everything. And it's very complicated to launch a fintech product in the US, especially if you don't have an operation already in the US. That was what drove when, really. And then, but it was quite interesting, though, to look at the difference in the landscape from when we launched in Europe. So 2011, I mean, I joined in 2012, and it was still very kind of, there was a lot of hatred at the banking system, the whole like financial crash and all the horrible stuff that happened in 2008 and 2009 was still quite fresh. And so we built our brand in the early stage as a kind of David versus Goliath, TransferWise versus the banking system. And in the US, actually, that the zeitgeist had kind of, you know, by the time we got to 2015 and certainly by 2016, that zeitgeist had shifted a bit away from people being angry at the system or the banking system to then, you know, Trump was a thing, Brexit was a thing, and there was this whole other zeitgeist, which, you know, our brand, interestingly, we were able to have opinions on both sides of that because we're rebuilding the banking system for people who live international lives. And a lot of Trump's rhetoric and Brexit was all about nationalism rather than internationalism. So we had to, I mean, you know, we learned a hell of a lot over the time, but there was this quite conscious shift of, oh, how are we going to nuance the brand, not just in a new market, but also in a new era?
What does it mean, do you think, to think ambitiously and globally about your brand from the outset? And I know that's kind of a very big question, but is there such thing as you're sort of devising the and thinking through your brand in ambitious and big scale terms? Joe?
I think that the best brands are ones that kind of tap into what, this is a bit of a buzz phrase, but the universal human truth is this thing you'll hear brand agencies say. And there is some truth to it. You know, if there's something that humans generally will agree with, and the brand is a solve for that problem or something that improves this state of mind or taps into an emotion that is shared regardless of where you live or who you are, then that is the seeds of a very powerful brand.
And do you think that cuts across, you have to factor in the international dimension of that universal human truth?
Definitely, but I think, you know, the brand itself really comes from who the founders of the company are, who the employees are, what they build, what customer problems they choose to solve. The brand may be experienced in marketing materials, but it's not. The brand's much deeper than that. And so where you see companies that try to be something that they're very clearly not, it never lasts and it always fails. You know, so I think in a way you can only really have one brand because the brand is just the truth of what the company is and who the people are. So I think then the role of taking your brand into different countries is more a question of localization rather than a rebranding exercise. I do think it's super important to retain the essence, but localize it. And I think, you know, this is a big debate around how local should you go and how far is too far and what's the point in forcing the same brand in this market if customers don't have anything to do with the customer who uses the brand in a different market. I could see that logic if it's something a very local product. But when it comes to online businesses, you really have one product that people use everywhere. And certainly for us, because we were specifically for international people living international lives, it would have seemed so wrong to have multiple different brand identities and things running in different markets.
I want you guys to just have a think about the sort of output that you did, the marketing output and the tactics and the strategies. And a good place to start is Joe. And TransferWise was very notable for its success in London in the early days. And I remember seeing these adverts or stories in the Metro, which is a London newspaper, of people being naked and attached to posters of nothing to hide, and seeing physical expressions of that outside Old Street tube station. Did you employ a lot of those tactics in the US?
Yeah, we did, yeah. But actually, just to clarify, we weren't completely naked. We had our pants on.
That's true.
An important point to make.
Family friendly.
So, yeah, we did. I mean, we had this assumption that, okay, so the growth mix that we'd discovered, I guess, in the UK, which was a combo of virality with an invite program as well, was the real engine of it, and then some paid channels and some organic channels and all that kind of stuff, and then some fairly expensive brand type stuff, you know, doing these big stunts and advertising campaigns. Our starting assumption was, let's try everything, I guess, in the US and see what works. You know, stuff like running paid search campaigns you could do anywhere in the world, and social as well. A lot of that stuff, all the online channels can really be done anywhere. But the thing that I felt was really, it was really beneficial to be in the US physically living there, was just to more on the creative side, you know, how to make content which is actually relevant and resonating with an audience which is so hard to understand from the UK. And then we did try some of the we tried the nothing to hide stunt, which, if you remember, was where in the UK in June, when it was nice and sunny, a whole load of us went and basically took most of our clothes off and did a protest outside the Bank of England to demonstrate how transparent TransferWise's fees were versus the intransparent bank fees. And so it was a sort of joyous summer day. Take our clothes off, make a great video of it. Sounds actually ridiculous in hindsight, but it was quite effective. When we did it in the US, it was January in New York, which I don't know if you've ever stripped down to your underwear in January in New York, but yeah, it was the coldest I think I've ever been. And so there was a whole crowd of us on Wall Street. I mean, the faces of these onlookers, they're like, what the hell are these people doing? When we did it in the US, we didn't really have that customer base yet. And we just didn't find that it had anywhere near the same impact, even though it was essentially the same stunt. What we learned from that was, yeah, okay, there's a lot of stuff that you can do in your home market where you're kind of a home success story in a way. When you're launching a new market, you do have to rethink, okay, what are some of these tactics? What are the things that we could only really do once versus what really does scale globally?
It's interesting. And Michelle, for you, not everybody might know this, but you were previously worked on dating apps Bumble and Badoo, and I wonder whether you employed a lot of the stuff that worked for those two when you were trying to get traction with mothers.
It's a great question, and the simple answer is not really any of it. There were obviously things that we and I had learned kind of along the way, and there were so many things that, you know, in hindsight, which is perfect, felt obvious. Of course that wasn't going to work. You know, there's something very different about having an ambassador program for students with a dating app and, you know, incentivizing them with some beer coasters or whatever it might be as their swag to bring their friends to join, versus women, in particular, the women who we were focused on at the start, which were new moms, who are extremely busy, haven't got, you know, a huge amount of sleep, and, you know, they don't need a tote bag. To the point about kind of just understanding the US market and marketing and messaging in particular and how different that is, I suppose what I had learned is Badoo had never really had a foothold in the US market, and it therefore had always become quite difficult to get into the US market. And I always had that as something in the back of my mind in terms of, I would never want to repeat this experience where I'm trying to get into a market almost too late in the game, for want of a better expression, and having a product which didn't feel suitable necessarily for a US market. Bumble obviously was the polar opposite, which is we were available in the US from the start, and no one really was aware of the kind of the back end machine of Bumble being in Europe. And so I suppose a combination of those two things made it very clear for me what I wanted to do from a Peanut perspective, to make sure that people felt like Peanut was a must-use product without people even questioning where it was from.
Christian, when you think about how you're going to approach the US, and I definitely hear you're very product-driven and very community-driven, to what extent do you think you need a sort of universal playbook? And how much flex do you think there needs to be for different countries, especially the US?
I honestly believe our product is our best channel for growth in the future. So I think if we are able to build the best product in the category and our users recommend the product to other users, we don't need to do anything really to enter new markets or to really expand, other than maybe pushing on sales. But what we're generally planning to do is to better explain what you can do with our product. So like promote use cases, customer stories and stuff like that.
Following your launch of Wunderlist, did your approach change with Pitch?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, GDPR has changed a lot, right? Especially in Germany, you have way more restrictions on what you can do to understand what your users are doing in your product to better influence growth. I think press has also become far less effective than in 2010. And I'm curious what the others think here. But like, I'm not focusing on PR at all. Really?
Why is that?
I think it's the growth strategy we have. It is like if we enable our customers to invite each other and the product basically becomes viral, why do you need to talk to journalists to promote your story?
Joe and Michelle, both of you, I suppose, have been very successful at getting a lot of press coverage for your products. Do you think it's shifted in that way that you can go direct to users now, and the getting your story into the media is less important today than it was, say, 5-10 years ago?
I mean, I think press has been important for Peanut, to be honest, because I think it helped us tell a story. You know, when we launched, and things are different now, but when we launched in 2017, you know, people weren't talking about motherhood in the way that we are today. When you thought about a product aimed at women and specifically motherhood, you were thinking about your own mum or, you know, the mums that you saw in a Pampers advert. It was very, very different. And we were coming out and saying something different, which is actually that isn't representative of the mothers that we all are and will be going forward. And also, what about women who are going through IVF or surrogacy or adoption or might not want to have children and are intentionally staying childless? So there was so much more to the story that we wanted to tell. And actually, the press helped us tell that story and still do.
I guess in a perfect world, Christian, you're totally right. You would just build the world's best product that doesn't need a single person or pound spent on marketing it. But I do think there's a role for, you know, for very traditional press in a way, certainly when it comes to telling the, you know, the sort of the corporate story or like the growth story, the tech scene story, and then ultimately the business press story as you become a bigger company. And in our case, there was a huge educational job to do because a lot of the problem we were solving actually was something that consumers weren't aware of. You know, a lot of companies, banks, you know, the biggest companies in this space were essentially lying about how much they were charging customers, saying it's a free money transfer, and then actually they're taking 5% based on how bad the exchange rate is, and customers just didn't know. So there was this huge job that we needed to do globally, really, to which is to kind of expose that problem. A big part of our press activity was about educating, and I don't think there's a better channel than press to do that kind of thing, really.
Are there, or were there moments with your stories where there was a kind of big spike or a moment which really shifted the gears a little bit and got you to a bigger audience?
When your ambition is to build a consumer brand where the number of customers needs to be
in the many, many millions, and the market share needs to be a significant chunk of the country, you do need to look at the world in a slightly different way and go after those big spikes. And that I think is one big difference between the UK, certainly, and the US. And the US is huge. I think it's foolish to think of it as one country, because it is more like a continent, and there are very few moments that you have in that country to reach the entire country. There aren't that many national moments in the US that have such a high percent of the whole country. There was one that we found kind of by luck, which was when we were featured on the show 60 Minutes. And this was really early in our time in the US, and we saw this huge spike in downloads, and that was what caused it. And then we spent quite a lot of time then trying to replicate that kind of, how the hell do you get into that mainstream American consumer media space? And it is so hard, because there are just so many other companies that all know that. And they all know that if you're on one of those shows where the whole country or a big percentage of the country is going to be exposed to you, then it can be game changing. I think the only way to approach the US is to really break it down and think, okay, what are the states or even just the cities or the communities, and how do I reach them, rather than thinking, how do I break America?
Michelle, what about you? Big acceleration points?
Yeah, actually, it was something similar. It was Good Morning America. And I remember walking out of an investor meeting actually here and just having this email from the producers at Good Morning America asking if they could come over and film, because they'd already been, they'd filmed a package with users of the app and they'd like to speak to the CEO. And firstly, an amazing moment. But secondly, you know, at that moment that I had to go back and say, actually, I'm in London, I'm not in the US. And they sent a team over that evening and I had to get my son out of bed and pretend that he was awake so we could film it. So it was a huge moment for us, because of course, absolutely, the US is not, you know, one. It's definitely different in different places. But Good Morning America is absolutely kind of unifying in that way. And, you know, women who have been up with their newborns or whatever are starting to watch it early morning. And we did see a huge spike from that. And other things followed. You know, we got lots of opportunities as a result. So that for me was an amazing moment, because they knew us. And they'd kind of put this package together before they'd come to us. We were the kind of final part of the interview and the package. And it was an amazing moment to see. But also, it's like I think for the US audience, it was a real stamp of approval.
Just one last question then, before we wrap up. Michelle and Joe, for you, if you had one thing that you would do differently with the benefit of hindsight, what would that be?
So my answer to this is more of a kind of inner workings of a marketing team answer, actually. And or actually not so much marketing, but the entire thing. So my model of how the org was structured when I went out to the US was, okay, we're going to create an entire tribe of people who are in the US working on the US. And we're going to try and distract the European team as little as possible by, you know, hiring a new person to do each of the marketing channels in New York, for example. And while in some cases that was successful, it actually meant there was a bit of over tribalism, I guess. There was this US team, and then there was the Europe team. And actually, I think with hindsight, it would have been better, even if it would have been slightly slower, perhaps at first, would have been to get, how do you get the whole global team to think about America, and then have key people that are definitely required in the market actually in the market. Eventually, the way the teams worked together got to a really good place. But culturally, I think it's in a way perhaps easier to create a new thing than it is to get your existing team to believe in a new thing. Do you see what I mean?
Absolutely. What about you, Michelle?
I think that when we started and when we launched, we had no team in the US, and notwithstanding, I was very able to kind of lean into a network that I had out there. You know, there are only so many favors you can call on from your friends, and just having that on the ground knowledge. It's not about kind of having necessarily a physical workspace. It's just about having someone living and breathing it. That would have helped us navigate, I think, the US market more effectively. But apart from that, ultimately, the only thing I would say is, if you are building something and it has the potential to make a global impact, there is absolutely no reason, particularly now given how we're all working, that any country should provide any barrier. I just don't see that there are these barriers that perhaps I was once told there were.
Christian, two final questions for you. First, what did you learn from your previous experience? And secondly, what's your top priority with pitch in the US?
I think the most, and I think that came through in this in this podcast, yeah, is that brand is your product, essentially. If you look at products like Slack and Notion, Dropbox, Spotify, Discord, tools that customers use on a daily basis, they really fall in love with the software you build and not the words you tell necessarily. So I think I can only give every founder this kind of advice. Try to build an incredible product. Build a brand around it that is likable, fun, unique, charismatic, honest, and real. We are just at the starting point. Like, pitch is publicly available for 3 months now. We're still working on our mobile apps, on a lot of core features that we still want to deliver for customers. So our focus in 2021 is just perfect the product to enable hyper growth in the future.
Next time, we'll be talking about relocating to the US with Pedro Bados, co-founder and CEO of NextThink, and Peter Lord, co-founder and CEO of Codat.
I was with one of my board members, and I just bought a house in the US, and I was telling him, look, three banks refused me to give me a mortgage. And he said, how is that possible? Yeah, because I don't have credit history in the US. I cannot get any mortgage.
See you then.